Welcome to Packet Pushers, the greatest data networking podcast that we've ever seen. And today what we're doing is we're going to be doing a bit of a retrospective as we get to the end of the year. While normal companies are out there talking about what'll happen next year, we're just going like, who cares about next year?
Yeah, screw predictions, Pharaoh. Screw them. I want to know what happened, not what's going to happen.
Predictions are what other people do because they don't actually have to do the work to make them happen. So you don't have to do it. But we've spent the year going back over our notes and thinking to ourselves, what could we do that would be useful to people? What would help them with their capability? So what we've done is put together some of the headlines for the year from January through to December, and we thought we'd hit them as a start-off. So instead of looking forward, we're very much looking backwards, and then we'll see how that takes us for the rest of the show. So let's kick it off.
Well, Greg, I got to point out something real quick first to set this up. Sure. Folks, yep. I'm wearing my fitness tracker with my heart rate meter, so when Greg says insane things and I see my heart rate start to go up, I'll know it's time for me to jump in and react. So I got this.
You got
and
this?
We'll see how this goes.
Metrics. Sure. It's all about the metrics.
I really believe you, sort of not. So let's kick it off in January. Obviously, the thing about January was we started to see the breakup of Brocade. And I think, I don't know about you, Ethan, but I had a sort of a soft spot for Brocade. I really thought that they were coming up and they were a challenger and we were going to see a bunch of things happen and it was going to be exciting and interesting. And then all of a sudden it disappeared. It sort of just fractured into pieces and I was really disappointed about that.
Well, right. I had that same soft spot as well. I looked at the team of people that they were assembling and the kind of products they were trying to put together, all related to software and programmability and so on. And it just like, yes, this is the future and it's coming from, of all people, Brocade. And then it wasn't. And so I was sad to see it all broken up because there's been some great people and products that have been flung forth into the networking universe.
That's well, right. It's not that they're being disbanded or thrown away. They've been picked up by Extreme. They're still going to exist in some form. It's still going on. I understand, you know, it's a little difficult when they move over to a new organization. You don't know how the organization is going to prioritize what they're up to, but they're still out there.
Yeah, all the pieces have moved on. We saw bits of it go. So, for example, in June, the Viata part, the software-based router part, went to AT&T, who bought that piece of the component. Mm-hmm. Which was really interesting, which is fascinating, I thought, because, you know, why would AT&T want to buy a software router, of course, and that's because they had that piece of the business. So it's going to be interesting to see how that works out in the long run, whether AT&T makes that available. But we then saw, as the year went on, we saw the switching business unit go over to Extreme. We saw the VCPE unit go off somewhere else. We saw the SDN controller business get set up into its own business. And finally, in the end, Broadcom had to relocate to the U.S. to get the sign-off from the FTC.
Brocade acquisition, yeah.
And sometime in around about, I think, July, Cisco went to the Federal Trade Commission to get protection for its Fibre Channel business because Broadcom could, you know, kill Cisco's Fibre Channel business by not being polite and by oversharing. In other words, Broadcom had to promise to keep Cisco's Fibre Channel silicon separate from Brocade's Fibre Channel silicon because Broadcom wanted the Fibre Channel silicon.
Yeah, so they had to get some legal protection, some legal assurances that Broadcom wasn't going to use its position as the maker of the Fibre Channel for both companies to give its own company now, the Brocade side, an edge.
Which was interesting, right? You don't sort of imagine Brocade, you know, we were looking at Brocade as a long-term, stable, you know, third leg of the Juniper, Cisco, and Brocade came up sort of focusing on the data center and was building out a pretty profound campus portfolio and a wireless portfolio, switched into the open SDN very early, and then all of a sudden it just, you know, ran into a brick wall and pieces flew everywhere.
Maybe the interesting part of this story is just Extreme Networks being the notable and surprising acquiring group for not just Brocade, but also Avaya. And so all of a sudden you've got Extreme Networks ranking, depending on how you rank these things, as number three in the networking industry, which just kind of blew me away. Because I had paid attention to them a while back when they were bleeding cash, but all of a sudden, when I wasn't looking, they've started to become profitable, build up their coffers, and now are acquiring assets and growing that business tremendously. And who'd have thunk it?
Yeah. A huge business now, because I think they're like nearly $1 billion worth of turnover, which sort of puts them on the map. And they've, you know, we haven't talk to them. They don't haven't briefed us or chatted to us about what they've been doing. But, you know, I always sort of had this vision of Extreme. What they used to say, it was Cisco and the Seven Dwarves, and there were seven smaller networking companies that Cisco sort of made sure they never ever grew up and kept beating them up. Cisco knew it had to leave some competition in the market, so it didn't. And now all of a sudden it's like Cisco, Juniper, Extreme, Arista, and that's it. And that's a big change over the year.
Well, it's interesting also to see where the competition for Cisco has come from. Other places like Arista definitely has been coming on strong. And then you've got folks like Cumulus, Big Switch, which are making inroads in the data center via Whitebox and Software Defined. So I think those may be inroads that Cisco hadn't anticipated.
Sarah's going to jump off into the discussion around open source, which I think was a theme that ran through all of the year here, and what open source has done to these vendors.
Well, open source has done a ton. So one of the shows that I'm co-hosting on our network is Datanauts, and you'll get the Cloud Native Computing Foundation with a whole bunch of open source projects that people are rallying around. On the networking side, we saw Free Range Routing has emerged here with Cumulus and several other folks in the consortium behind that, a fork of Quagga. We're still seeing the Cord project out of, what's that been rolled into now? That's part of ONAP. I've lost track of all the acronyms, but that is still a very big deal for a lot of the carriers, and a lot of things are written to that Cord spec. And who is it, Peyton, that we interviewed, Greg, kind of making the point that you don't have to go to a big vendor to put together a network. You can kind of build an open source network with a lot of available tools, and his argument is almost, and why wouldn't you, based on the economics of it?
And I think, you know, there's been a couple of signature things that happened this year. One was OpenR being open sourced by Facebook. OpenR is, it's not a routing protocol replacement. What it does is it's a messaging replacement for what we use router protocols for. So most people use BGP to send messages to neighboring autonomous systems. That's the bulk of what BGP is supposed to do. But as a messaging system, BGP is really quite poor. And Facebook says, well, we're working at scale. We need something better than BGP because it just doesn't work at scale that they're working at, or for the granularity that they want, or whatever it is. So they came up with this thing called OpenR. Now, OpenR isn't fit for routing really, and it's still got a lot of work to do before it's going to be something that ordinary people can use, but it's a step. It's a new routing protocol that hasn't come out of sort of like the IETF or the traditional crucible of vendors. Well, it's the only routing protocol to emerge in the last 30 years, really.
And I think that gets to a larger point, is that what's happened with the open source movement is that they've done an end run around the traditional vehicles for getting software out the door, which is either a vendor or some kind of long and interminable standards process. And so by going open source, some big companies like Facebook or Amazon or Google, the big web scale folks, can say, this is important to us. We're releasing to the open source community. We can put some resources behind it, and we'll also glean any advantage that we get from putting it out to other people to play with, and then we don't have to wait for anybody else.
So other projects, AT&T talked about their DNOS, Distributed Network Operating System. They want to have a unified network operating system across all their routers, all their firewalls, anything to do with their NFV. They want to have one operating system, and then the vendors will bring their apps on top of that NOS. And they want that NOS to not only run on 1RU pizza boxes, they want it to run on chassis, and they want it to run in VNFs, so virtual machines. And they're sort of, some of the things where, you know, when big companies make these prognostications, you sort of go, you know, that's just words, that might not get. But AT&T has actually stood by a couple of things. It's talked about its domain 2.0, and that worked. It's thrown its weight behind ONAP, and that's turned, you know, into something where ONAP is now being used by a number of carriers as their SDN controller platform. Cord and ONIS and ONAP are all sort of welding together to come into that space. We've seen Cumulus team up with a bunch of other people. I think it was Cumulus that was leading that effort to make to fork Quagga into free range routing. And the FRR code base seems to be innovating quite quickly. The BGP daemon in BSD suddenly caught up. Some of the people there who are the code maintainers realized that things weren't being done, and some of those people coming. So I think there's been a lot of, you know, open sourcing is actually taking bites out of the easy vendor revenue. Like writing a BGP stack's not rocket science. It's relatively trivial. If you talk to people like Russ White, who we have done on shows, he'll tell you that, you know, writing a BGP isn't easy. You just pull out the standard and you implement the, you know, work your way through the standard, you implement code for each of those sections, and boom, it's done. So if all of a sudden writing a BGP code on an operating system is really simple, And, you know, you've still got the hard stuff to do, which is to get it into the kernel or to forward packets at speed. What happens to the value that the vendors bring to the customers? I think there's some disruption happening there.
It goes back to what you were mentioning, Drew, the self-determination that open source is giving these companies that have the ability with internal development staff to create a very specific customized process for themselves. Mm-hmm. They can make the tools that they want that feeds their business, and they're no longer beholden to vendors or throwing a pile of money at a vendor to make it happen. They make it happen themselves in their own timelines using open source as their platform to get that done, the springboard to create this. And that's interesting in that it's the big companies that were traditionally throwing massive, massive dollars at the Ciscos and the HPs and so on of the world to do that. Now keep that revenue for themselves, and maybe they're spending it in a different way on development staff because open source is free, but it's not free by any means. But it's changing the economics, and it's changing the vendor landscape dramatically.
Yeah, I'm really curious because we've seen a lot of the uptake happen either in the web scale or the carrier space where there are organizations that have the development resources internally to make an open source project at this scale viable. Not necessarily what's going to happen in the enterprise, but the thing about open source is that the developments that happen sort of at a higher level eventually start to trickle down into the market. Like we saw the way Linux sort of started to infiltrate the enterprise over time as it became more stable and people found more use cases. I'm curious to see if we see the same thing happening on the network stack.
It could all come unstuck too, because, you know, it took years for Linux to get to the scale and size where it became the universal thing. Whereas networking is, you know, there's less network devices in a given network or a given data center or a given, you know, use case,
right?
You know, it's always possible that this might not happen, but, you know, the stink that's coming off open source actually smells like it's, you know, there's something actually happening there. It's not just...
Yeah, the number of devices is an interesting one because you can do more, you can do a whole lot more with less because the forwarding and the silicon is enormous these days. And so the average shop doesn't need to buy switches and switches and switches as long as they've designed their infrastructure such that the port density, they don't need a lot of port density. Man, you can plug in and get enormous forwarding capability in just a couple of switches. And I was reading an article the other day, I think it was on ipspace.net, Ivan Pepelniak's blog, about a design that a vendor had put together saying, oh, well, you know, just in case you grow, you got to have, you know, a couple of spines and, you know, some extra leaf switches just in case. And he's going, yeah, but why? What? If you designed your infrastructure correctly, you only really need two, which again goes back to the, it cuts down the number of devices that you need. So you don't need to buy devices and devices and devices. So there's volume reduction there. You don't need to buy a lot of protocol complexity if you've designed your infrastructure well. It becomes a simple thing and a commodity to have networking. And then you look at folks like Cumulus who are taking that a step further and saying, just buy Whitebox, put Cumulus on top. They're documenting and blogging at an enormous rate in great detail about what you can do with their operating system and how to get it done, breaking down an adoption barrier, I think, which is very key. A lot of open source projects are difficult to adopt because you can't make heads or tails of the friggin' thing unless you were on the inside of the project. But
I think also companies are starting to realize that that participating in open source projects has value. Remember, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, people were saying, oh, enterprise will never use open source in infrastructure because, you know, they can't participate in project. And guess what? DevOps is doing, you know, they're using Chef and Ansible and Puppet and Kubernetes and, you know, open source software from everywhere. They have open source programming languages. And in fact, getting them to buy commercial software for DevOps is really quite difficult. So it's not like it's a given to me. See, the thing is that if that was true, if enterprises were completely not on open source and it was going to be rejected because, you know, insert your favorite excuse here, the simple point is that over here in terms of public clouds, they're using Linux. If you're over here in the enterprise, most software is coming out on Red Hat, right? Linux. If it's if you look at where your DevOps teams, they're using open source IDEs on open source languages, using open source tool chains and open source container software and open source orchestration engines and APIs and very little of that is closed source. So why is it that enterprise IT would suddenly be, you know, the last bastion of closed enterprise IT, pay for everything, you know, outsource all of your maintenance?
Because support, Greg, that's where we get support from, is that trusted vendor. You know,
all right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's the opportunity for the legacy guys to throw that FUD out there and say, you're going to go be a cowboy with all that open source stuff. And so, of people like Cumulus, Big Switch, and others, the way they add value is by de-risking this white box and open source move.
And that's great, right? And that is valuable. And that's but even Cumulus is a packaging of open source tools, right? And it's not like they're charging. You know, I can remember paying $25,000 for the operating system to go on a Switch. I think the most I've ever paid was $75,000 for one license on one Switch. Whereas now you're seeing Cumulus charging what, $1,000 a year or $5,000, you know, and $750 a year in maintenance or something like that. That's a big downgrade in revenue, right? So, you know, I just wonder how much of this open source software is replacing easy vendor revenue, is forcing them to work harder and also shifting their cost base higher. Keep in mind that the vendors have to run a 65% gross margin to keep their investors happy, which is one of those things. I want to take a break here. I want to talk a little bit about what we did this year, Ethan. We launched a membership system, which was pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah. Man, if you guys listening to us could hear all the background on that.
You got to put a little bit more life behind that either.
Well, I'll tell you, the membership system has been an ongoing thing that Packet Pushers have wanted to do. And you're listening to us chat about, you know, on this call, there's so much background conversation that's gone on. We actually migrated to a platform a few years ago that was supposed to take us there, and we've started to use it. Some of you have signed up as a free tier, non-paying members, to get access to the Link Propagation newsletter and Human Infrastructure Magazine, et cetera. And the long story short is that platform we moved to is just not going anywhere and not going to do what we want to do to provide for all of you listening the kinds of content that that we want in the way that we want. And so we're building our own. Well, we're contracted someone to build it for us, but yes, that's where things are headed, and that is something that is an active project we're working on, and hopefully we'll have something to show you in Q1 of 2018. Q1, because we're a vendor now, we deliver on quarters. You know, that's Q1 2018 for the beta release to folks, and trusted partners will be but anyway, we're looking at a March timeframe.
We'll have hopefully. The branding. We'll be having branding meetings and right. Launch programs, and we'll have the product management team in to get their feedback.
There, in a weird way, there is some of that going. It's just more Packet Pusher style, where it's a little more informal. And we're really, the membership system is intended to deliver a whole variety of things that we've wanted to do for years. We love our sponsors and appreciate the fact that we can do this every day because we have sponsors that come in, and we keep working with them to deliver content that doesn't suck. But we'd like to be less dependent on sponsors and also be able to look to you folks in the audience. Many of you have asked us, how do I give you money? This will be your way, but it won't just be you're throwing, like, you know, Patreon style money at us. You'll be a member of a system where you get access to content you can't otherwise get, is the whole idea here. And we've already been working on courses, you know, video courses, and some white papers that we have in mind, newsletters, and maybe there's some of you out there who have been looking for a way to share something you've written or that you have in mind that you'd like to make some money on yourself. This will be a platform that you can do that too, because we're building it with third party authors in mind, so that you can come on board and share your stuff with the networking community or other people in the IT world. Yep. As you know, we've expanded.
So what we've done with blogging. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there have got one blog post in there, but putting it on your own site, you know, once a quarter, getting four blog posts out of year doesn't get you much exposure, and you feel like there's not much value. So sometimes people come and post on our site, and we'll get them in front of an audience. And I actually think it's that user stuff which is almost more valuable than a lot of other stuff.
Well, it's the user stuff that, you know, that operator level engineering that we've never wanted to get away from entirely. It's important for us to look to the future and do a lot of future analysis where the market is going, and we've got a lot of our shows and things that we write about are like that. But then there's also things that are right now, today, what can you do with X tools? So, for example, I wrote something about a Wireshark capture filter, hardly new, and it got all kinds of traffic and interest from folks. And a lot of you that contribute to the Packet Pushers community blog, people that write things like how to do a layer 3 diagram gets enormous amounts of traffic because, and we recognize that, people need that practical, hands-on kind of content as well. And so we've always wanted to do some of both, but mostly with an eye to the future and what's on the bleeding edge.
Sure.
And just to let folks know, make sure it's clear, for this premium content side that we're talking about, if we bring in third-party folks to write or contribute on this private premium content side, we'll do a revenue share. So it's not just money going to us. We'll share the wealth around depending on how much you sell, then you get a portion.
Yeah, exactly. And that's been a big part of the
design process. There's so many smart people out there. So many smart people out there. Mm-hmm. You know, people who do this every day. Why aren't you taking the design you just did and, you know, denaturing it, taking out all of the stuff that relates and sharing it? I mean, what do you think a vendor best practice document is? It's just a design they did for somebody else and then took all the proprietary stuff out and said, well, that worked once. We'll sell it to 100 other people because we're too lazy to actually be, you know, it's not like they're going to do something different. Every customer is exactly the same. So it's one of those things. Well, let's keep on moving with the show. So keep an eye out for the membership system coming next year. We do have the membership now. It's free. And if you sign up, you get Human Infrastructure Magazine, Link Propagation. And we've got a couple of other pieces of content that only are available to members. So maybe you want to go over there. If you go over to packetpushers.net/members, you can sign up. It's free. It's not SSL, but it will be when we get the site sorted out.
Oh, yes.
So jump.
Let me park on that just for a second, Greg, the new site will be 100% SSL. We just want everybody to know that. Because it's hard for us to do SSL on the existing site right now, but the new one will be SSL end-to-end. That will be your only choice. So that's happening. Another point to make here for existing members is you'll get transitioned to the new site at some point. That's something that'll happen this year as well. So look out for that. We'll notify you. It won't be hard to understand. We'll just say, hey, you have to log in over here now. And yay, that'll be a thing that's done.
Yeah, and it's always been a problem because podcast feeds and SSL, we did actually switch to SSL and then have massive problems.
People that was a difficult week.
Speaking of difficult weeks, in April, HPE bought Nimble Storage. We started to see HPE, even though it got rid of all of these old legacy business units into Micro Focus, it started blowing up about $1 billion. HPE buying Nimble Storage was the first in a sequence of purchases that HPE made throughout the year. May was a big month. VMware sold the vCloud Air business to OVH. You remember that one, Drew?
Yeah, that's right. OVH, aren't they a French cloud provider?
Yeah, they're a French hosting company, pretty big. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Wanted to get a lot bigger, and VMware's vCloud Air business, they decided that, you know, being in the public cloud wasn't such a great idea. And it was only a couple of months later we saw VMware on AWS, which people are still getting upset about, I noticed the other day.
VMware trying to be a public cloud provider was not a great idea. They sold that business, but they didn't walk away from the public cloud. They know they're still trying to make sure they're relevant in the public cloud, which led to that AWS partnership that we've talked about quite a bit, and I'm still scratching my head up over a little bit.
Well, I still think the VMware and AWS thing makes sense. It's people's, you know, VMware's customers are going to AWS. You know, we've seen them and now talk repeatedly. And I saw Cisco talk the same thing. They're saying that 87% of the enterprise will be in the public cloud within 5 years at some form. So if you're a company that wants to sell something to these companies, you have to have a product in the public cloud to sell them. Remember, I talk about my supermarket theory over on the Network Break podcast. You know, if you're building a supermarket, you want to make sure there's products on the shelves that your customers who come into your supermarket want to buy. So I think you're going to see a lot more of this. And VMware got rid of the vCloud Air because they couldn't scale it up. They didn't want to drop $5 billion a year building it up. Whatever AWS and Google and Azure spend.
It's funny how the big companies are struggling to capitalize on public cloud, how it's forcing everyone to shift their business models. And a lot of them have moved from this direct compete model to something else, some other way they're trying to capture revenue while people are moving to public cloud. It's tough. It looks really tough for a lot of these folks.
So that was followed by Riverbed bought Xeris Wi-Fi. So Riverbed has been building up an SD-WAN portfolio. I think back in 2016, Drew, they bought a German company that had been making
Ocedo. Yep, Ocedo, yeah.
Well, look at you. Outstanding. Yeah. And
sometimes the memory fires, sometimes it doesn't.
If I remember rightly, May was kind of the month where SD-WAN in the branch was a thing. Was that the month when there was all this smoke coming out about, you know, SD-WAN as a branch technology?
That's right. It was sort of let's collapse as many functions as we can at the branch into your SD-WAN, and maybe even including some Wi-Fi capability, a Wi-Fi controller right at that SD-WAN gateway device.
Yeah. I think people sort of realized that SD-WAN at the branch gave you an opportunity to do more than just like switch flows across multiple bandwidth.
It speaks to a deeper issue, though, and that is SD-WAN as a technology by itself perhaps is getting more difficult to sell. And the ultimate play then is the branch in a box that includes SD-WAN technology. So I think of Meraki as a prime example of that, where they got this branch in a box that does all these things, and they've added some SD-WAN capability into that platform as well. And certainly that seems to be where Riverbed is going, and the sell is, hey, simplify your branch needs, drop in this one box that does all the things, and off you go. You no longer have to put four or five boxes that that do the multitude of things you want to do at your branch to help you standardize.
And aside from that, with the Xeris acquisition and the Ocedo acquisition, Ocedo also makes actual switches. So I think Riverbed's thought was, we'll give you that branch device and also at the branch, put in our Wi-Fi controllers, our Wi-Fi devices, put in a switch or two, and we'll own it soup to nuts and also, you know, slap some nice user interface over it.
Yeah, so, you know, and we'll talk more about SD-WAN. I think that's something that we'll dig into as we get deeper down the stack. But I think in May, we also saw Intel close its IDF conference, which was a bit of a disappointment because I used to like the Intel IDF conference. HPE walked out of the OpenSDN project. They packed it up and took their bags and went home.
Yeah, IDF, that's the Intel Developer Forum, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was a good...
I think I actually did attend one of those, and it was interesting because Intel's been making some efforts to be more relevant in networking. So having them shut that down was a little disappointing.
Well, it's not that they backed away from all of their networking and
no
technology. I mean, they still got a big investment there, but it's just it seemed like Intel had done some other changes with different projects they were involved in and on what level. And it wasn't that they necessarily pulled out of all these technologies. It's just that they, we're not going to do this and that's not moving the needle for us. And IDF was one of those things. And I agree, there was some really interesting content there and it seemed quite well attended, but they pulled out of it. Again, not that I remember them killing any of the projects that they were on as such, just some of their involvement. Like, I think OpenStack, they backed out of something.
Everybody backed out of OpenStack. And I think that they moved DPDK to the Linux Foundation. So they'd sort of been custodians of the DPDK and been trying to drive it in a particular
direction. Intel name was divorced from DPDK, and DPDK stands alone now, yeah.
But, you know, other than that, I just, you know, we'll talk more about foundations later on, but it's funny how foundations were all the rage earlier in the year. Drew, remember every week we'd say it's the foundation of the week as every vendor would create a foundation.
That's right.
And it was kind of, and I think we used to make jokes about how not to be open when you're trying to look open.
Make your own foundation.
Create your own foundation, and then you could select who was a member of your foundation so that if anybody you didn't want to be a member of your foundation couldn't get access to your open source project.
So is a foundation different from a project or different from a consortium? It's so hard to tell.
Well, it's like the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, right? It's basically set up by the Pivotal people to make sure that the people that want to get in on the cloud native idea that they sort of came up with are going to do it their way. And it was very, Kubernetes was a foundation, and, you know, all these other things were all foundations set up, and the people who created it wanted them to be open. And the other one was Juniper. Juniper did the Open Contrail Foundation. When they released Contrail open source, they put it in a foundation, but put it behind a login. You had to apply, and only people who were approved could get logged in and get access to the code. So it was open, but not very. As I talked about today.
Some were more equal than others.
That's right. Yeah. It's not that you're not welcome. It's just that you're not the right sort of person to participate in our open foundation.
Or you need to do it our way. Yeah. We want to have some control over it.
There's dozens of them. Google was doing it with Kubernetes. And anyway, they've all seemed to have collapsed. Those foundations have all been handed over to Linux, to the Linux Foundation, because they've got an infrastructure and that to handle all of that, I think. Sustaining that. So I thought that was funny. And then, of course, the big news in May was Cisco acquiring Viptela, which would then go on to close 3 months later in August, so that Cisco now has a true SD-WAN technology, which follows like about 18 months of us getting our ears bashed by people saying that IWAN is just dreadfully, awfully bad.
Well, that was, for me, that was, frankly, I think one of the biggest stories of 2017, because Cisco had put so much effort, so much marketing, so much development effort behind IWAN, to then go out and buy Viptela just felt like, okay, you're right, we didn't pull it off.
Well, and it's also interesting who they chose to acquire. In acquiring Viptela, Cisco grabbed the biggest, baddest SD-WAN solution that was out there, and some people are going, hey man, that's not nice. I don't have Viptela. But Viptela, it was scaled up huge. They'd done a lot of internal code and so on to build the solution to what it was and what its capabilities were. And Cisco went after them. And I remember a few years ago talking to someone off the record who worked in the Cisco sales organization, mentioning that we are tired of Viptela kicking our rear ends. IWAN is losing to Viptela all over the place. And that was in early days. And so they finally just said, if you can't beat them, join them. And they're going to join us. This is how it's going down. And it looks like, it doesn't look like IWAN's being sunsetted exactly, but the noises seem to be all the energy is going to go into Viptela.
IWAN was always a bunch of technologies littered in the rubbish bin of iOS. You know, it was a bit of IPsec, a bit of PFR, and they said if I just put all these together, it could be an SD-WAN. We don't need anything new. We can just use our if only. But it turns out that none of that code worked very well.
Right. We've got NBAR, we've got PFR, we've got IPsec. We can just wrap it all together and call it SD-WAN.
Yeah, and it didn't work very well because, you know, most customers, Cisco doesn't do, seems not to do very much testing and validation. And then when they tried to make it work, it all didn't work very well and customers struggled to get it to work. And you're talking about an awful lot of complexity in the CLI. And even when they built the GUI to go over the top, they built it on top of Cisco Prime, which perhaps, you know, has had a fairly checkered history as well. So in the end, they bought Viptela, which was a great move. I think most people were pretty interested about that. And we haven't actually seen the collapse in the SD-WAN market. As soon as this was announced, we saw a bunch of product managers at various vendors saying, oh, that's the end of the SD-WAN market now. There'll be one more acquisition and we're all done. And weirdly, that hasn't happened.
No, it's still a hot technology in that you need what SD-WAN gives you, particularly for optimizing that traffic across networks you don't own, as in the public internet, which so many people are going to. So that driver is a use case that's not going away and is only going to increase. So the technology, in whatever form it survives, is not going to leave us soon. So it makes... I think there'll be, well, we predicted this a long time ago, Greg and Drew. This isn't that it was hard to predict. There's got to be consolidation in the SD-WAN space because there's too many players. So the acquisitions make sense. Much later in the year, we had VMware buying VeloCloud. That just happened recently. There'll be more of that and then maybe some smaller players that have been in niches right along that may begin to lose customers because bigger vendors now have that offering where it used to be a niche play before.
So moving into June, we saw IDG ditch most of its staff at Network World. Lots of people thought that was pretty strange because they thought Network World was the big thing, but it was great for us. So I'd just like to say, thanks, IDG. And then Target settled the lawsuits. For those of you who remember the big Target breach from about 3 or 4 years ago, it actually settled all the lawsuits for the breach for about $200 million. Overall, I still reckon Target got off dead cheap. I think that cost them less than about $300 million for the whole thing, including rectification. Still cheaper than paying for 10 years of IT security, like decent level. In June, does anybody remember Cisco talking about fog networking in June? Remember that?
I remember fog networking. Yes, I was like, oh, great. Something else.
One of these days, Cisco product managers will realize that trying to come up with some sort of fancy name and getting it to stick is really not a great idea.
Weren't they behind the Open Fog Consortium or some such thing?
Yep.
I suppose it's still out there. Who knows? But it hasn't gotten any press lately anyway. But yeah, fog.
I think it was an Open Fog foundation. Yeah, there's an Open Fog. Yeah, that's another one of those foundations. You know, we're open, but not very. You have to come in. Yeah, I think the idea there was that they were trying to put a handle on IoT networking and to give it a name that they could control and own. And I just thought it was interesting to point out that a number of times Cisco's done this and it's never really stuck. So we'll see how that goes. In June, AT&T bought Viata, as I talked about earlier. But the big news, of course, was at Cisco Live. We were there. Was Cisco announcing intent networking or intuitive networking, or as it's now known, SD Access, which was actually big news. Software-defined campus.
Yeah, a big, massive product aimed at one of their core type of customers, that the big enterprise who want to control and be able to manipulate traffic at a granular level with an orchestration system. I want traffic to flow in this particular way, and this is how I intend for it to work. And it's based on Lisp on the back end from the reading I've done, and certain kinds of hardware and chipsets are involved, et cetera, to make that happen. And it's very early days, and there was at the outset of the announcement, it's like, okay, we're going to be delivering this over, well, I think there was a 2-year time frame that Uncle Chuck said. And you know, we'll see where it goes. Early reports have been not great from people that have tried out some of this technology, as is not uncommon for new releases from anybody, but certainly Cisco as well, where the first stuff out the door is kind of, and it gets better as time goes on, and we'll see what happens with their intent networking.
That's right. I thought it was interesting, one, how quickly Cisco hopped on that intent networking, which is an emerging technology category.
Yes.
Bandwagon. The other thing is, it was more evidence to me of sort of the Meraccization of Cisco internally, where they've seen the success of Meraki, and part of that success is built on centralized controller, very easy to use, and it's again the same thing with Viptela too, is another data point there. Wanting to bring that simplified management and monitoring layer down into the campus now, onto the wired network and not just at the Meraki layer.
Do I really have to hire a CCIE to manage my network? Can't it be easier? Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, let's take a minute to talk about Cisco in 2017, because they've been trying to sort of transition away from the old model. You know, you sell your switches and your routers, and then you put them into support for 10 years, and boom, away you go. And, you know, I talked a little bit earlier about everybody's moving into cloud computing and all the surveys and the results that are coming back. Like when we get to talk to executives from VMware, they're saying to us that, you know, the cloud is inevitable. The enterprise is moving a substantial part, you know, for whatever term of substantial. It could be 5%, it could be 50%. It's never going to be all of it, I don't think. But and you know, these companies, at Cisco in particular, doesn't control the cloud or the web scale market, and doesn't seem to have a dog in that hunt. And so it has to come up with ways to replace the revenue that's being lost as enterprises. Well, I think at the moment they're slowing down their purchasing as they start to look to the cloud. They're saying, well, we won't invest in upgrades for the next 10 years. We won't invest in, you know, future budgets over the next 5 years to add more. We'll just sit with what we've got, start moving stuff into the cloud and seeing where it's going. And all of a sudden the revenue's just sucking out of the market.
If I'm a C-level that's given my company a directive to move to cloud, and maybe I haven't thought more about it, but that's all I want, is to get out of the business of building my own infrastructure and hosting my own apps and move as much of that functionality off to the cloud as I can, then I'm certainly not investing in my infrastructure this year, because in theory, I don't need more capacity, one of the hugest drivers for network upgrades. I should need less capacity over time because I'm moving it to cloud, right? So there's nominal investments in things like maybe your internet connectivity and direct links to AWS or Azure, but you're certainly not buying more Cisco switches, not if you don't have to, because you're trying to bleed down that volume. So, right, where is Cisco going to get the revenue that they would have gotten with your sales rep rocking on up for his annual visit to take you out for lunch and firing off a brand new PO for a bunch of Nexus hardware? You're not doing that anymore. You're saying, yeah, Bob, thanks for lunch. And our spend's going to be down a bit for next year and the year after that.
We're not sure that we're going to, we think we can skip that next, those line card upgrades in my Nexus 7000 for a year or two. You know, we'll just run the virtualization a bit harder so we don't need so many switch ports, and wait until we need them.
Just a heads up, though, AWS is not going to take you out to lunch. You're going to miss those steaks.
don't panic. AWS does have resellers now, and they'll pay for the steak.
Okay. Somebody's got to pay for that steak.
Apparently, the enterprise isn't moving fast enough for AWS, so it's starting to hire an enterprise sales force in some guise or another.
It's not just, you know, public cloud that's eating into Cisco. I mean, that's happening. It's slow, but it is definitely happening. Their annual reports have shown some of the percentage is down in different of those hardware categories, but it's also Whitebox is there. It's also Arista is there, and Cumulus and Big Switch. Some of the traditionally huge Cisco accounts have gone over to other providers now that are giving them what they need for less of a spend or in a different, more desirable way, whatever those questions are. VMware NSX, VMware, one of our sponsors, as is Cisco, by the way, has been talking about NSX everywhere, and that's been central to their messaging, and they keep trying to drive NSX ahead, which was part of the VeloCloud acquisition. That's nibbling into Cisco revenues as well. So I think the question, Greg and Drew, what is Cisco doing to recover? These are not stupid people. They know they can see this happening, and they've been trying to pivot as a software company. I mean, what successes do we see them having that are going to move them ahead for the next 10 years?
I don't know that they're ever going to get back to the heyday. They're still going to exist, but I think they're going to have to make up, essentially be a smaller a shrinking company, but they're looking to make it up in different ways. So one is IoT, making very strong efforts to be not only providing the network connectivity, the infrastructure for that network connectivity of IoT, which may be a significant growth over time, but also provide some of that compute layer sort of out at the IoT edge, that fog element through UCS. And again, with UCS, they're leveraging that into this hyperconverged market, which will sort of, they're trying to position as the private cloud for the enterprise.
I think they've done a few things. One is they've come up with this Enterprise One licensing. So what they're doing is double down on charging existing customers for the products that they're buying. So instead of, in effect, I think that the net result of this software-centric and the recurring licensing, the yearly licensing, is it's a way to increase the selling price without making it too obvious to the customer that they're paying more. And I think that's going to ultimately cause a problem because if Cisco tries to take more money out of the customers that it's got left, like the ones who aren't migrating away to the cloud, it actually makes the cloud more attractive, if you know what I'm saying. So, you know, if they try and say, well, we'll raise our prices and go up market, then it actually makes the alternative options more attractive. But I don't think that Cisco has much choice. It's still stuck with very high costs. It has very high headcount. It relies on a very expensive sales force, and the way it goes to market is very expensive. It has to sell a product. It has to have enough money at the point of sale to cover not just its own internal sales, its internal pre-sales, its internal marketing, and its internal product management. It also has to provide money for the distributor in all over the world, and it has to provide money for the reseller, and the reseller has to be able to cover their costs. And this whole chain of feasting on the customer's dollar is perhaps, it's to me, it starts to feel like this is a legacy business model, and that's exactly what AWS and Google are feeding off, is that customers want to deal directly with the vendor. And there's no big long food chain, you know, sucking up the product.
But you're describing if they shift to that software model, well, what's a software delivery model look like? And it's radically different from the hardware delivery model. So your sales model is very different. You're going to do most of it online, and you're going to be able to swipe and buy. Your distribution goes away because that's all digital now. So you don't need, warehouses, and you don't need parts for SmartNet contracts where you've got warehouses all over the world storing replacements. It's just that, so a lot of your overhead and headcount go away over time. And so in theory, you would see a lot of layoffs as the company, quote unquote, restructures and does their reorganization. In other words, retools their internal processing to support a new software-focused distribution model that cuts out a lot of that overhead and then get back to the profit margin.
Well, see, I like the idea. Like, so in principle, that sounds really good, but I think that Cisco's ability to execute here is questionable. So although they've started to discontinue some of the iOS product lines, there's still 13 different or 15 different, I don't actually know how many there are, it's certainly more than 15 versions of iOS that it runs across its devices, right? So it's actually got all of these different business units writing and testing this software. And judging from the number of complaints that we receive about unreliable code and, blatant bugs that should never have been shipped, and, which one of these 52 different versions of code for my one switch should I actually be using? Would you actually trust a vendor to automatically update? Like, I trust Apple to ship software for my Mac that works every time, and I'm willing to click upgrade and trust that it's going to go.
But I trust them less and less, but in general, I agree with you.
They had a good track record until recently, yeah.
Yeah, so they've had a bit of a hiccup. So, but on the whole, they've earned 5 years So I'm willing to put it down to, but I've, on the reverse side, if I look at Cisco or Juniper, less so for Arista, judging from the feedback that we've had and all the other vendors, just sort of the glaringly, obviously they didn't test this bugs before they shipped it, are starting to really drag them down. And people are saying, like, why am I working on this rubbish equipment? With just so many hassles and annoyances on it, why am I just not leaving and going to work in some other market or some other business? And that's why so many people are heading into working for the cloud. Like, how many people have you seen leave enterprise IT and head off into the Kubernetes sunset, the Kubernetes enhanced sunset somewhere?
There's an interesting question here, which is, at what point does it hit Cisco revenue even harder? And again, not just Cisco, but anyone who's in this legacy hardware, software delivery model. Now, we've seen a slow trickle, right? We've seen a slow trickle of small number of percentages eating into switch and router and so on sales. But I wonder if there's a critical mass coming where there's a whole bunch of enterprises that have finally said, got it, we're going to public cloud. Boom. And then maybe 2018 is the year where we start looking at quarterly revenues for Cisco and HPE and others and see the enterprise sales just drop into the abyss and go, holy crap, that happened faster than we thought.
Well, the thing is that Cisco,
you know, sorry, I actually don't see it happening that way, sort of like a, you know, a big hunk of a glacier calving into the sea. I don't see it happening that way. To me, it seems like more like death by a thousand cuts because enterprise still has a lot of legacy applications. And while everybody's talking about moving to the cloud, there are still barriers to moving to the cloud. You've got process, you've got cost, you've got your culture, not to mention existing applications you have to keep up and running. And new opportunities for Cisco like IoT, as I said, but I think, so I do think there's an erosion. It's going to be a continuing erosion. Mm. It's going to be slow. And Cisco's hoping that in the meantime, it can sort of make this transition into a new and different company that's not entirely dependent on shipping you expensive silicon.
Okay. So just one of the things we've reported on in Network Break for the last 2 years, Drew, is that for 9 consecutive quarters, Cisco's enterprise business unit shrank between 2% and 5% every quarter. Mm-hmm. So this is not a hypothetical. This is a real thing.
Absolutely,
right? And that's a lot of money. That's like nearly $750 million in revenue that just disappeared. Mm-hmm. Now in this quarter, Cisco finally stopped the shrinkage, and they finally stopped shrinking their top line, and their share price went up. But the enterprise stuff still, you know, finally stabilized at some sort of much smaller than it was 3 years ago type of thing. And now they're actually no longer cutting it up. So we're not actually going to see the enterprise shrink anymore because they're changing the way they're reporting. So the things we've just talked about are actually happening when you measure the numbers, right? And we're not necessarily going to see it going forward. But the same thing's happening to HPE. HPE took all of their legacy software business and moved it off to Micro Focus, sold it all off in a multi-billion dollar transaction. They took all of their professional services that they built up all over the year because they were going to be an IBM-like professional services company, moved it into a business unit called DXC and then floated that as a separate business unit. You saw Dell and EMC merge for exactly the same reason. EMC was obviously shrinking rapidly as well, and they knew that the end was coming for them because they saw they knew what's the same thing was happening to EMC as what's happening to Cisco, shrinking at substantial rates for 4 to 10% per quarter. So merging with Dell all of a sudden gives them scale. They're bigger. So now all of a sudden they can reduce their costs, get access to a larger market, and you can do very well. And by all reports, Dell is in great shape, that the EMC acquisition is paying off, although the EMC assets are shrinking. And in particular, Dell's doing very nicely out of VMware. So I think we've probably done enough on that topic. So then what we saw in July was the Cisco versus Arista lawsuit reach its peak nasty point. Do you remember that? When the chief counsel for Cisco got on his website and sort of went, "Ooh, we won one." That was pretty funny.
There was a lot of back and forth there on who was winning what, depending on which court injunction came down at what point in time.
Yes. It just, that was like it reached its peak pettiness and it got really we won one over you. And I thought come on, please. And funnily enough, we haven't actually heard much from them for the rest of the year.
It felt like we spent a lot of time talking about the intellectual property tennis match and who was up and who was down. And Arista seemed to be getting the best of it. But yes, Cisco notched a victory and did do a little nanny-nanny dance.
It doesn't seem to have hurt Arista overly much, if at all. They've had some changes they've had to make in code, which, as far as I understand it, they've shipped and
They've really rolled with it. Yeah, hats off to
Arista. They're doing great. We talk about their financial results on Network Break. They're growing at a very, probably at the rate that they maximum can. So when you're growing a hardware company, unlike a software company, you've got to build the hardware, you've got to have it in stock, you've got to ship it, all that sort of stuff. I think Arista's probably growing just about as fast as it can. And it couldn't grow more even if it tried, but it's growing very rapidly. And every time it does its financial results, it highlights just how much market share they stole from Cisco, which I do think is a bit like poking the bear, but there you go. It was in August that ONAP got a big boost from the telcos. All of them got together and basically agreed that the open daylight controller that we used to know from 3 or 4 years ago would be folded into a thing called ONAP, and a whole bunch of telcos have stood up and saluted. And we've actually seen some practical deployments around ONAP. So sort of, and I've always said that open daylight will probably go into the telcos before it comes back out for use as something else. We saw Google talking about its Espresso SDN. So the it has its own software-defined network internally, and they started talking about their version 2 of it, which they now call Espresso. I can't remember what the first version was. Lots of people got excited about that, and then slowly people got the realization that, you know, what's fine for Google, it doesn't actually work for anybody else.
It's a whole different scale.
When you realize that Google's backbone is, you know, sort of like about half the size of the total internet or something like that, or some outrageous number, it's like, yeah, great. Good work, Google. Not so useful for us. Big Switch announced its partnership with HPE, which is quite interesting. I think that a lot of people sort of said, you know, small-scale SDN, like what Big Switch is doing. And there's been a lot of rumors this year about, you know, all of the startups are all going to die. They're all running out of money, and they're all up for sale. And people keep contacting me. I love people contacting me with rumors. I love hearing about them. And then companies like Big Switch seem to just steam onwards and onwards. And Big Switch partnering with HPE was actually quite substantial because it's already doing deals with Dell, and Dell is leading with that quite substantially in a number of customers for data center.
I've talked to a lot of these startups, Greg, and I always ask them about their cash. And usually it's confidential. You can't speak in specifics, but you hear a lot of they have enough run rate to keep on rolling and doing development for a while through their Series A, B, C, D, E, and F. And they have customers, but just not enough for them to be self-sustaining is the story over and over and over again. Yeah. They have customers. They have people that love their product, but just can't seem to, you know, kind of get that, yes, we're here, we've got this thing going. Which is a bummer because there's some really cool technology out there that you know is going to die because I just didn't get enough groundswell.
You know what I think it is? I think it's a fact that a lot of these people all worked over at the other company, and then they come over to this company and they're used to dealing at the scale of a big, you know, $50 billion organization. And when somebody says to me, you know, your product budget this year is sort of, you know, tens of millions instead of hundreds of millions, and they go like, this can't work because it's just not big enough. And they just haven't got their brains around running a different type of business. And the problem with Silicon Valley, as we've talked about many, many times, is that most of the people there aren't actually very good. If you're lucky enough to be in Silicon Valley and to find a house and to make a life there, you can just be hired by any of these organizations. You're not actually likely to be very talented or very good because you just happen to be the only people they can hire.
It's a mix. I mean, there you end up with the same spread that you have in a lot of organizations where there's a few people that are those rock stars and the movers and shakers, and then the rest of people that are, you know, there. Yeah. And there is a talent pool to draw from. If you're looking for people that can do X kind of coding or have a certain kind of skill set, the action is still in Silicon Valley, and they want you physically around. For all the talk about remote work, which a lot of companies do and support, that's another thing we hear from many of our startup friends. Yeah, I work in, you know, Kentucky, but all the action's in Silicon Valley, and so there's certain conversations, certain things that happen within the company that I just can't take part in because I'm not there.
Yeah, and I don't want to be there. So the final thing to happen in August that sort of caught our attention was Cisco put a ring on SpringPath's finger. For those of you who remember that SpringPath was a hyper-converged platform that Cisco, just before it seemed to go broke, Cisco suddenly put it on life support, started giving it cash and rebadging it. And now that's become Cisco's hyperconverged platform. And I think Cisco was like the last player who was making servers to enter hyperconverged. We saw Huawei and all the others get in to the hyperconverged platform. And, of course, Nutanix has had a stellar year as they've continued to grow and beat off all the competitors. Ethan, this is right in your wheelhouse with the Datanauts show and what you've been doing over there with Chris. You know, that whole hyperconverged thing, I think, is a real going to be where it's going to be.
It's one segment of where it's going to be for sure. In other words, there's a certain kind of customer that's going to love hyperconverged because it just makes things easier. Moving towards that model of what I like to call the push button data center, you don't want to be thinking about your storage as a thing and your compute as a thing and your networking as a thing. Geez, just put it all into one box for me and give me a nice GUI that manages it all. Why does this need to be so hard? And if you're not trying to super fine tune and be very precise because of this exotic application that you have to deliver and maximize your compute cycles where you've got to have all this crazy tuning, and most companies don't, why wouldn't you make it as simple as possible? Go HCI. And interestingly, a lot of the HCI folks are now integrating with public cloud. So if you want to run some stuff on-prem and be able to easily integrate your public cloud workloads as well, you can do that. Many of those HCI folks are going that route. And so Yeah, that's a great way to go. Then, and again, why wouldn't you head that direction if you could?
Yeah. And I think Drew and I, we've talked about that repeatedly, that hyperconverge seems to have a lot of legs. Makes sense as a way of, you know, getting away from the Lego block assembly and getting a pre-assembled kit, you know, instead of trying to do it by hand, comes as a bundle.
Right. And we've also got VMware playing very strongly in this area, Dell EMC, HP also putting some money behind hyperconverge. And I'm really curious for 2018 to see what happens with Azure Stack.
Yeah. So we've seen VxRail from VMware, where they're trying to make their vRealize private cloud stack actually usable instead of having to do the self-assembly yourself with 12 different products. So that'd be useful. And in September, probably the one part that I actually had most laughs about was Solaris dies, which was excellent. That made me so happy when Oracle laid off 2,500 people and finally said, Solaris is dead, which was good.
Well, and then many people reacted with, oh, it was alive? So that happened. Well, yeah.
I had so many Solaris people over the years tell me how awesome it was and, you know, it was the best ever and blah, blah, blah. And back in the day when I was deploying Windows NT 4.0 for a fraction of the price of Solaris and doing all the things that it couldn't do, you know, in what took them 6 months and a team of 30, I could do one person in 6 weeks. And they'd be like, oh, but, you know, it doesn't scale and it's not, you know, you don't know Unix. I'm like, yeah. Suck it up, suckers. we also saw Huawei launch an SD-WAN product. Just to point out that everyone's got an SD-WAN. If there's at any point you doubted that SD-WAN is not a thing, by September when Huawei launched an SD-WAN product, they actually have three or four. They have some based on MPLS, which you know, and they have others based on SD-WAN appliances. And I think they even have one that's a bit like IWAN, which is based on their routers. So be careful if you're going to go and buy one of those. And then finally, in October, we saw Gigamon taken private by Elliott Management. That's probably a good point to talk about. Gigamon, $1.6 billion taken out of the public market, so we don't know, you know, like the others. Ixia was bought this year, which was also a visibility company, for $1.6 billion. We saw a lot of companies sucked up by these private venture capitalists or private funding.
Private equity.
I want to comment on Gigamon specifically, Greg, that I suspect part of the driver, what made them look attractive, is their pivot towards not being a security company, but certainly catering heavily to the security market and to security use cases. That seems to have done very well for their bottom line and make them look like an attractive buy. And the alliances they're making with folks like Splunk is pretty interesting. Stuff I got to see at one of the Tech Field Days this past year. That security market, geez, you can't keep it down. It's still a massive growth market and still like the latest emerging space for startups and interesting ideas and so on.
Yeah. And we've seen a lot of companies. So we also saw, what were some of the others, Drew? Barracuda?
Barracuda Networks was taken private. That was Thoma Bravo. That was also $1.6 billion.
And we saw a couple of bits of Brocade taken private by various private venture capitalists as well as other parties. There was rafts of them throughout the year. And so it's always a bit of a thing. And the hard part about it is when they go private, we don't get much visibility into what they're doing. So we don't actually know what they're doing with their businesses. So it's hard to find scuttlebutt to talk about on the network break. But hey.
You know, that's one of the upsides of going private is that public scrutiny of your quarterly financials just goes away. And you can just run things under the covers.
Yeah, that's right. And without that scrutiny, you can do decisions make decisions and choose paths that don't necessarily make sense, as Dell has shown.
Instead of having thousands of investors to piss off, you just have a board that you have to worry about, essentially.
Some tens, but they're the ones with the money.
The ones who are holding you by the short hairs, yes.
So in November, I think one of the really biggest news, and perhaps the most surprising to someone, was that VMware announced its intention to buy VeloCloud. So this is not necessarily the SD-WAN outcome that some people expected, although I think I was predicting it right back at the beginning of the year, Drew.
Did you predict VMware or did just the VeloCloud was going to get picked up? I don't remember.
I think I said to you that VMware is going to have a branch networking solution around about June timeframe. It does make sense that NSX needs to connect the branch because you want the branch to talk to the data center. And at some point, they're going to want to do it. Now, whether they would buy something or just extend NSX into the branch in some way, it would be, you know, I don't think I got that far down the speculation trail.
Right, right. Yeah, okay. So maybe we can give you credit for that.
I'll take a partial. I'll take a half. I'll take a half.
You get an assist.
But definitely in talking to VMware and the VeloCloud folks about the acquisition, there was part of it, the motivation was for sure, eventually our goal is to link into NSX so that you can get this, you know, software-based control over the network pathing from the branch all the way into the heart of the data center.
Mm. And I think that's going to be interesting because effectively VMware now has a WAN networking product. And VeloCloud, so I'd also noticed VeloCloud's unique proposition was always that it had these cloud gateways. So the way that it would work is it has all of these POPs all over the internet, and then where you connect to on the edge, it then connects to the nearest of its POPs, and then...
And then you're sort of riding over their own private backbone, right?
That was and they're optimizing the internet because the internet is actually not optimal. There is a path, and it's probably not the best path that's getting you across, because people are using BGP to make sure that they can screw each other over and charge each other for bandwidth that they stole from somebody else.
So you hit a cloud pop, you sort of ride over this, you know, black box, and then pop out somewhere else at another VeloCloud pop, and then onto your destination.
Yeah, and they do some like fancy stuff to it in their backbone, but they pretty much de-emphasized that. I suspect that that's not very popular with customers somehow.
Trust us.
I don't think they're de-encrypting it. They're doing TCP optimization and stuff like that. But I just think that it's something that if you try and explain it to a customer, they just don't get it. There are other companies that had built SD-WAN products like that, and they haven't been enormously successful either. They're working fine with small to medium companies who don't really have the skills or the talent to understand that. But I don't think they've sort of been able to break through into some of the bigger ones who sort of say, yeah, actually, I just want to... I think SD-WAN splitting into two markets is like the ones who just want to replace their routers and then replace their backbone providers. And so that's a sort of market that Viptela and a few others were into. And then VeloCloud sort of went, no, we can actually do this in a much different way. So we're going to do it. And that's not just replacing routers, that's replacing the entire way that you go to market. I just wonder if that's smart because customers want to buy what they know, and it might actually be making a rod for your own back per se.
I want to follow up on a point you guys were making earlier introducing this topic, which is that part of the excitement here is the ability of VeloCloud to optimize branch to headquarters traffic. Is that what you said?
Yeah. So I think the way that VMware was pitching it when they acquired VeloCloud was that they wanted to extend the micro-segmentation in the data center out to the branch so that the apps would all be in micro-segments and that it would be a security play as much as they were about the optimization.
Okay. I think in the long term, I'm not sure how much that matters, because ultimately, if all of the data is living in the cloud, the more interesting optimization becomes branch to cloud as opposed to branch to HQ, and you end up optimizing things like maybe VoIP and things like that that are where you want a direct path endpoint to endpoint, and but branch to cloud becomes more interesting since that's where all your apps actually live, which doesn't take away from the micro-segmentation application. That is still a very valid use case.
Yeah, and when you're thinking about the retail use case, you've got a lot of applications that are communicating back to a central office, some kind of centralized data center. So being able to do that micro-segmentation and that security and PCI, that being able to have a single policy that you can push from the data center out to the retail edge, I think could resonate with some folks.
I think it makes sense. NSX is going to be a networking strategy, and it's going to be software-defined. VeloCloud is software-centric, it's not hardware-centric, and that's probably the biggest or the most simplistic reduction of the VeloCloud versus Viptela type SD-WAN strategies going forward. I want to shift over a little bit about intent. There was a lot we talked about in 2017 about intent-based networking. In particular, we saw companies like Apstra and Anuda, who have both been sponsors on the show, talking about their intent-based networking products. And that's intent-based networking is kind of like this idea of, why do you need to know how to create a VLAN? Why don't you just say, I want these servers to be in the same IP subnet, and somebody goes off and works out what you need to do, takes your intent and makes it happen. And then, of course, when Cisco moved in with its SD access and intent-based networking, that sort of validated the whole market, and then it sort of blew up. Everybody wanted to put intent paint all over their products.
We were slapping a coat of SDN on everything. Now we're slapping a coat of intent on everything. Although I have to say, I feel like watching the progression of this whole software-defined networking, which started years ago, and we've been looking at different iterations of it, intent seems like, sort of inside that, if we look at a Venn diagram, intent is sort of inside that SDN circle. It's sort of what we were talking about, essentially, but they've just called it something else and slowly working out all of the intricate pieces that need to be coordinated and orchestrated to actually make some kind of software-based decision that essentially cuts the human out of having to do all of the manual configuration.
Yeah.
That's where it goes eventually. And if you look at HCI, just as a to step back to that topic, if you can bring all of the what you need out of your IT infrastructure into one brain and simplify things, then, you know, does networking really need to be hard? And I've had this conversation with many of you that are listening going, yes, it does, because all business needs are different, and so it's going to be unique and snowflakey. No, it isn't. It isn't. Eventually, it's not. And intent becomes real just as soon as the network requirements become a little more simple, and then it becomes very easy to drive those through software and just say, I need these things with these characteristics. It's not only going to be things like, I need all these servers in an IP subnet. It's going to become more abstract than that. I need, from a business perspective, to have this security model executed, and then however that looks will be taken care of at an even more abstract layer over time. I think that's where this gets. So there is a lot of intent paint being being painted all over everything, and but there is ultimately a reality to it, and the needful work to get that off the ground is being done by the Apstras and Anudas, and in a different way, coming at it from a different angle, the Veriflows and the Forward Networks of the world.
Yeah, there's no inherent value in being able to configure a firewall with source and destination IP addresses and TCP ports. You know, it really should be something that's automated in some way. Because the company wants you to make a decision about the policy, not actually writing firewall rules. And yet I spent years writing firewall rules in, you know, vast firewalls of enormous complexity just because no one had thought to automate it. Why was it necessary? You know, why didn't I know why hadn't firewall vendors made it so that they knew what protocols this app needed?
There were businesses that made their money helping you audit firewall rules. Audit them.
I just want to mention about this intent base, and Ethan, what you were saying, that the reaction you get when you talk about why does networking have to be hard, part of it is because people have developed a set of skills and they feel like if automation comes in, then they're out of a job. But I think if intent really takes off and automation really takes off, the problem is going to switch from one of configuration to one of, or maybe a couple of things. One, is this configuration that I've set up actually meeting the requirements that I wanted? And if not, then something has to be changed. And two, sort of this visibility and metrics around what kind of performance am I getting? Is it optimal? Do I need to make changes? And then troubleshooting. What happens when something goes wrong somewhere? You're still going to need folks who know how to go in and do things. So the intent is not going to drive networking skills and capabilities out of the market. It's going to shift them in different directions.
Yeah, your ability to speak some arcane command line interface is no longer a skill. Your ability to understand fundamentals behind this, like I have a security policy that lets this traffic talk to this thing, is that allowed? And if I do that, what is the impact of that?
When a new endpoint comes online, do I need to validate this intent that it actually happened? And then I need to make sure that the performance is meeting all the business requirements, et cetera, and so forth.
And that's why intent is important, because we're going to have vastly more devices on our networks. IoT, we're going to have more laptops, more iPads, more smartwatches, more smartphones are all going to be connected to those networks. And you're going to need to be orchestrating them. The idea that you could manually configure all this stuff in the years ahead is just not practical. And you just obviously haven't thought about the fundamentals here. And that leads me into this discussion about formal verification. We've seen two companies come forward, Veriflow and Forward Networks. We've spoken to them, or you will be hearing from them in the new year. These companies are actually using mathematical modeling of logical networks. It comes out of somewhere else. It's a mathematical basis to be able to.
It comes out of Boeing, I think, actually.
And they're actually able to model your network in software. So you can click a web interface and say, if I put this access list on this device in this place, will everything work? And it's actually able to model the impact of that change in your network infrastructure and say, hang on, these flows would suddenly stop working. And you could go, that's not such a bright idea. Maybe that would be bad. That's a resume generating event, as they say.
Mm-hmm. But some of you have argued with us about that kind of technology and said, well, that's nice for the software model, but the problems I have are in a particular line card, and does it model, you know, some specific switching ASIC? Well, no, they don't do that, but don't discount the technology completely because of that. Some of you guys just want I want it to do all the things, but there's an incredible amount of value in just being able to model what your software and how it's actually converged, because these Veriflow and Forward, they actually look at your hardware, or they actually look at your network devices and whole, not just configurations, but actual state in the network, and then demonstrate to you that, again, intent is being met. So there's a lot of value that goes in there, even if hardware is not specifically modeled as such, you cynics.
I know, like any technology that starts out, there's going to be gaps, and you know there are things that in all that, yes. But I think this is a hopeful thing. One of the things that we've talked about a lot is that the vendors want these networks to be simpler and easier to operate, but they also want to add value to them. And the way that you can add value to them is to actually make them work the way you think they're going to work, which is, you know, the bug shouldn't be there. Or if I made this change here, something unexpected happened. It's not possible as the networks grow and get more complex, you know, as they SD-WANify, you know, or as the data center moves in half here and half in the cloud. The traditional paradigms or the way I think about networking, you know, it's all in control, or theoretically I could actually visit it all and I'll actually own it all. But that's all going away, because it's not just not going to be all the abstractions that we're putting in place and the disaggregations and the convergences and the hyperconvergences as we reassemble the disaggregations into different lumps, just changes the way that and we need to have new tools that give us visibility. I guess that takes us into discussions. We've had several podcasts this year with Kentik and Deepfield, who've been deep into the analytics and the visibility part. And I think that is another expression of this desire to know what's happening in our networks, right? You know, these people can take flow data or syslogs or any type of data, munge it up together, and suddenly tell you your applications are good, bad, insecure, this is not happening. And they're doing it at with massive scale machine learning and you know, sort of artificial intelligence. And just changes the way they think about it.
And more companies that are in this space as well. We did a show with ExtraHop. They're mining packets, all the packets, and pulling all kinds of data out about them. We've talked to CPacket a few times. They have hardware that will analyze at line rate. They've got boxes that do 40 gig and up to 100 gig. I talked to a company called Lightstep.
Just think about 100 gig. That's like nanoseconds between packets.
The point being is that these guys are pulling in every, you know, CPacket, ExtraHop, Kentik, Deepfield, they're pulling in all kinds of data at an extremely granular level, not just sampling to pull out and making their inferences and analysis of the network. Lightstep, a company I talked to just yesterday as we're recording this, they're up the stack. They're at the application level monitoring microservices on ephemeral infrastructure where things are changing all the time as autoscaling scales containers up and down to deliver an application and are able to monitor telemetry at a very fine grain. And so this is... And almost all of these services have some kind of a cloud aspect to them where you're actually pumping your metadata into the cloud and they're doing the analysis there. You don't even have to. In some cases, there's not even offered an on-premises solution for their tool. It's a brave new world. It's a whole different thing rather than back in the day where it's like, okay, so I'm going to get my packet capture tool and it's going to have a 15 bazillion terabytes of storage and half a rack just so I can keep up with what's going on in the network. SaaS and public cloud and compute power that scales means you can subscribe to a service that does this for you in the cloud and gives you everything, all full, deep, detailed analysis right down to every single packet or log entry, depending on what level you're monitoring at, of what you're trying to keep up with. Absolutely dramatic change in the industry that doesn't seem to be slowing down at all.
And I think this ties back to a point I was trying to make earlier about intent. As we switch away from the value in the network being, I've configured this system, you get to, that's why you're utilizing tools like we've talked about. The value you're bringing is, okay, I'm seeing performance, I'm seeing potential issues, I'm tweaking for performance, I'm serving the business. And as you know, these organizations, these companies get better at machine learning, we can start to get into predictive analytics where you can say, you know, so we've seen this trend before where, you know, some spike is coming, so be prepared, take steps X, Y, and Z so that we don't get a brownout or whatever.
The predictive aspect of that, Drew, is such a key. Rather than being in that place that so many of us have been as networkers or infrastructure engineers on some level, something just turned red, I better go see what that is, and then you react to it, it's predictive where, oh, this is starting to go bad and that's going to impact you in this way. That predictability means you can get out in front of problems. And machine learning is not just machine learning paint in some cases. It's actually real where that's happening. And that is, again, a dramatic change from the way things were. That reactivity of, the, oh, crap, red light. Oh, I've got an email. Oh, I've got a page and have to do a thing now. You can keep the user experience consistent, staying out in front of these problems with these new tools. I think, sorry, I'm like waking up and getting excited all of a sudden because it's one of the areas in IT that feels like the needle's moving. It's not just a bigger version of what we had before. Things are actually changing to make the practice of IT and being in IT operations and infrastructure better and improving and, interestingly, aligned with cloud, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah. So security, I think the last 2017 was absolutely the year of the security breach. And of course, our favorite kicking boy of 2017 was Equifax, Drew.
You can't kick him enough, in my opinion.
It was just so much stupid, really. I thought they really had no idea what they were doing. And it was so obvious that they were running an enterprise IT security strategy where just nobody cared.
Yeah, it may not even have been they didn't know what they were doing. There was just at the executive level a lack of care, a lack of taking seriously the duty of protecting people's most precious financial information. And that just
at every turn, they just seemed to be so like, you know. Anyway, we talked about it plenty on the network break, but I also wanted to pull out the S3 data buckets.
And that seemed to be a weekly occurrence as well. Having your S3 data bucket publicly available on the internet, not a great idea.
They're finding like, you know, hundreds of gigabytes of data out there now. Terabytes of data in sometimes of just personal data or, you know, NSA data or whatever, just amazingly. And of course, there was the IoT vulnerabilities. We saw lots of cameras getting hacked, stuff like that. And I just sort of, you know, it seems to have slowed down though. It's almost as if like there was so much hoo-ha that all of a sudden things have... We've actually had governments get involved and start to say to these vendors, you either have to be secure. If you're not careful, we'll legislate. Mm-hmm. And they went, okay, we better do something. Have you noticed the reduction towards the end of the year? Although Amazon door thing got hacked.
It's gotten a little harder for the last week in AWS newsletter to come up with the S3 bucket violation of the week. I think he actually got a week off in there for once.
Things like that. Let's just face it that IT security remains the comedic joke that just never stops giving. For me, it seems like every week there's just like some basic incompetency going on at a sustained and continuous level right across the entire industry. And perhaps the one thing that I observed, was it last week, Drew, that security in AWS is just as bad as it was in the enterprise and potentially worse because so many people are now just scanning AWS for vulnerabilities.
Well, this is where I pushed back on you a little bit last week. I don't know if we can necessarily fault AWS. They're trying to put the tools and controls in place, but if you don't use them, that's on you.
And that's exactly what happens in the enterprise.
Well, that's you take a bad practice in the enterprise and run it in the cloud, you're going to get the same bad outcome.
Exactly. This is my point, is that it's not AWS or private cloud infrastructure that was insecure. It was always the people that were implementing and, you know, doing something and ran around the back of my firewall or put data outside the firewall or put it on an FTP port and then told me that it was FTP. And so it's secure. And then somebody would just take the data using something else. And I'd be like, well, what can I do? It's not like I'm able to solve the problem.
People are a problem.
Well, I think we're coming to the end of our wrap-up for 2017. Now, look back and prognostication about what's been happening. I hope it's been useful to you. Are there any closing thoughts, Ethan?
Oh, man. You know, it's funny that you mentioned security as, it was 2017, the year of the security breach. Yeah, but so was 2016 and 2015. So I'm pretty sure 2018 is going to be epic and awesome in those regards.
That is the safest prediction you can make. You can take that to Vegas.
Another comment I'll make just aimed at the audience and all of you is we have a strong 2018 plan. We've already been recording shows for publication for next year. We've got much of quarter one, January, February, and March all laid out for shows across all of our channels. We're looking to add at least one more new channel next year. This engine is running. We're firing on all cylinders, baby. And we got a long-term commitment to this thing because at the moment, everything's going great. And so thank you to all of you that are listening. Tell your friends and so on. Thank you to our sponsors that are helping make this possible for us to do what we do here.
What a privilege it has been. What a journey, but what a privilege it has been to for you to give us your attention. And we try to pay it back every single week.
Absolutely.
Really? We do the best we can with what we've got. Drew, any closing thoughts? Do you want to tell the audience how much you hate them? Just to have like a... No?
I need to learn from you how to bite the hand that feeds us a little bit. I want to say I have the opportunity to interact with folks, listeners and practitioners on Twitter and Slack. It's a great group of people. I'm very happy to be part of this community, even though I'm, you know, not necessarily a technologist, but coming from a reporting background, I'm delighted to be part of Packet Pushers and delighted to be working with people and talking to you. And like Greg said, we do take our responsibility seriously to do the best we can with these shows, and we hope the information is useful. And also one quick note, we also started a new podcast this year, Briefings in Brief. It's taking all the vendor briefings we get, condensing them down into 5 minutes or fewer to get you the good nugget of information as fast as we can. So look out for that as well. But thank you everyone for your attention and time. We love it. We value it. And we'll be back in 2018.
And thank you very much to you for listening, but also a big thank you to all of the sponsors who have worked with us throughout 2017 and made it possible for us to do this. Literally, since we've been able to go full-time, we've been able to put out better quality podcasts, and the audience has actually grown, I think, 70% this year, Ethan?
It's been substantial as we've looked at our subscriber list. It's gone up quite a lot.
Yeah. Subscribers are up like well over 70%. Downloads are sort of – so we've got a lot more people tuning in to the shows. Downloads are up. The numbers move around all over the place, and metrics are hard to calculate, but certainly we've increased our audience substantially. So thanks very much to our sponsors and to you and the audience, and thanks for listening to this Packet Pushers weekly show, the Looking Backward, predicting what happened in 2017.
Don't look back in anger.
Don't look back in anger. Look back in sadness, because it was. Yep, that's what happened. So this is our last show for 2017, but we'll be back in the new year with even more. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog. Look, you can blog. Everybody's got a – maybe you want to blog about something over the Christmas break and then send it to us for publishing in the new year. We would love to be able to give you a platform so that people can see and hear what you have to say. You can also follow what we're doing on Twitter as @PacketPushers. You can find us on LinkedIn. We have a company page there. We post all of the activities and the latest articles and podcasts go there. So if you want to follow us there, it's really helpful if you could like us on Facebook. And especially if you could rate us on Apple Podcasts. Apple Podcasts is absolutely something like 85% of you listen on Apple Podcasts, according to the statistics. Who knew? But if you could rate us on Apple Podcasts, then that helps us find more people, and that helps us to survive and to grow and keep this train rolling down the hill. And last but not least, as always, remember that too much technology would never be enough. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to all of you from us at Packet Pushers.